I'm Sandra Smith, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Wednesday, August 1st, 2018. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Can the government stop a Texas gun rights activist from releasing his plans to 3D print firearms?
The mere fact that life may be threatened is not enough to stop speech. You can't do that. Speech is that important.
I'm Dave Anthony. They're picking a jury in Virginia. For the first trial, for former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort.
They're only after him using extreme measures. Three indictments, two different judges, two different jurisdictions, solitary confinement, in order to squeeze him to cough up whatever he knows about his former boss, now the president.
And I'm Jonah Goldberg. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
It might sound crazy, showing people how to manufacture undetectable plastic guns at home on a 3D printer. Even President Trump seemed to scratch his head, tweeting yesterday, "I'm looking into 3D plastic guns being sold to the public. Already spoke to NRA. Doesn't seem to make much sense." But that's exactly what web developer and gun rights activist Cody Wilson from Austin, Texas, wants to do. The State Department tried to stop him after he posted a video in 2013 of what appeared to be him firing off his Liberator pistol made of plastic parts from a 3D printer. The video tells people to download the plans to print the gun parts at his website, Defense Distributed. The government said that at the time violated international traffic in arms regulations, and you can't have people in foreign countries who we don't sell arms to manufacturing arms. Wilson took the government to court in 2015, and this June, the Trump administration settled the case, allowing him to release the blueprints today. That prompted a group of Democratic senators, including Ed Markey from Massachusetts, to demand the president do something.
This decision is as dangerous as it is confounding. Not only will people be able to download these guns here, but Hamas will be able to download these plastic guns in the Gaza. It not only is a domestic security, it's an international security issue as well.
It also led several states and the District of Columbia to file a lawsuit to stop him. And late yesterday, a judge in Seattle put a temporary restraining order on Wilson, preventing, for now, the release of the blueprints.
This is not a gun case. This is a free speech case.
Josh Blackman is Cody Wilson's attorney. We spoke with him minutes before he was heading to court to argue the case brought by several states, led by Washington.
What these state attorneys general are trying to do is reach out and censor the speech of a citizen of another state. And they're trying to do this in an unprecedented way by seeking a global injunction. You've probably heard of a nationwide injunction. This is the global injunction where a single judge can shut down speech of Americans around the world.
So let's just get to the meat of this here. I've heard, for example, you just said to me, this is not about guns. This is a free speech issue. But I've also read your client write, if you want your Second Amendment online, this is the fight. So he's clearly saying this is a Second Amendment issue as well, right?
Oh, it is. And Cody's a provocateur of the highest order. He's very good at what he does. But Cody has a fervent belief that people have the right to make their own arms, and this is one method of doing it. We've argued in courts for years that these regimes violate the Second Amendment.
Talk to me about why this is a free speech argument, though, and what the precedent is here that you're relying on.
There was a very famous case called the Pentagon Papers case. You probably saw the movie The Washington Post came out earlier this year. In that case, the U.S. government tried to get the New York Times and the Washington Post to suspend the publication of the Pentagon Papers. These were these classified documents about Southeast Asia. The Supreme Court said unanimously that no, the government cannot censor this speech. It's not permissible.
Yeah, why is this speech, though, the same? Because in this case, this speech would result in, obviously, the production of a weapon.
Well, so too, with the Pentagon Papers, the revelation of those papers could put our troops overseas at risk. And the court said the mere fact that life may be threatened is not enough to stop speech. You can't do that. Speech is that important.
Senator Markey from Massachusetts said, can you imagine, and I'm paraphrasing him here, can you imagine like Hamas getting a hold of this and printing guns? I mean, is there any legitimacy to that kind of argument in your mind?
I think the short answer to that is these files have been available for years. All the files that Cody put up have been available for years. So if Hamas wants to get them, they can already get them. 3D printing didn't invent plastic firearms. They've been around for some time. And with respect to the good senator, there are more important things that he's probably worrying about than Hamas downloading 3D printed firearms. They're far more pressing issues on the government's mind.
Can you foresee this case sort of pushing things to the limit? Because I know you just said the Pentagon Papers, for example, could put people at risk overseas, but this would be like an actual printable, tangible product that could be used. At that point, isn't it more than just about speech? It's about being able to make a product, being able to almost sell a product.
Well, let's be careful. The states still have the power to ban plastic firearms. They can still do that. I'm not arguing against that. What they can't do is prohibit the sharing information to get there. There's a step, right? If you share the information, then you download it, then you make the gun. The government can ban it later in the process. They can't ban the mere sharing of it. These files have been studied in universities and museums and art galleries. They have value other than making firearms, and that's value protected by the Constitution.
When the State Department initially got involved, they were worried about international traffic and arms regulations requirements. You know, people we don't sell arms to manufacturing arms. But they transferred oversight of firearms exports to the Commerce Department, which got rid of those requirements. Wilson's attorney Josh Blackman says that relaxed things, not on gun exports, but on exporting information about guns, like 3D gun printing blueprints in his mind. The State Department Tuesday called the issue now a domestic gun control issue that needs to be addressed by Congress and law enforcement. Sam Beeler's a law student at NYU who's been studying 3D guns.
The untraceability issue, it certainly poses challenges for a lot of what we'd like to know to see how guns move across borders, and that can provide valuable law enforcement intelligence. But as far as the actual crime goes, again, I think you have to ask, are these going to become widespread enough and attractive enough that they are diverted for use in crime to such a degree that we displace the existing stock of illegal arms?
Could you foresee somebody in the black market doing that, buying a 3D printer, becoming very well acquainted with how it works, and building these weapons for other people and selling them?
Hypothetically, that's possible. But when I described that scenario in 2013, and I think it's true today, it was mostly to point out that it's relatively non-viable and not particularly profitable. You have to do a fairly large number of sales of what's not, frankly, a particularly attractive weapon. It's worth remembering that these, certainly the plastic liberators, have a single relatively low-powered shot. They've been known to explode in the hands of their users. So you're not talking about a particularly attractive weapon. You have to move a decent number of them. And what we know about the underground firearm market is that it's not particularly big. Those Hollywood scenes where you pull back a curtain and it's just rows and rows and rows of shiny, pretty-looking rifles, it's not how you're seeing a lot of guns moving in the United States. And it's also worth saying that to the degree that, again, one wants to become a black marketeer in the United States, it's questionable whether their better option isn't just to be moving firearms across borders from low control to high control states, or from weak control areas to strong control areas, rather than setting up a 3D printing system to try and manufacture something that's already readily accessible.
Even if 3D printable guns aren't super effective now, that's not to say that they won't be in 5, 10, 20 years.
I think that the reason I'm less worried about them is not that they won't become cheaper or more effective over time. As you point out, they almost assuredly will. Right now, the degree to which gun violence in the U.S. will go up or down isn't, and to my mind, is not likely for the foreseeable future, to be contingent on the degree to which we maintain a tight control over 3D printers. Now, as I said, in the future, if we start to reduce the number of avenues by which conventionally created arms become more accessible, that's when 3D printing starts to become a real driver of gun violence. But my goal has always been to kind of encourage policymakers to focus on the areas where their time and their legislative energy is likely to have the most effect. And so if they're, the goal of Congress, if the goal of state legislators and AGs is really to curb gun violence in the United States, I think their attention is more profitably focused elsewhere.
In other words, it's so easy to get a gun already made in so many other ways through so many other avenues that worrying dramatically about 3D printed guns is sort of a waste of energy at this stage.
Exactly.
Well, Sam, thank you so much for your time.
No, my pleasure.
This is Jonah Goldberg with your Fox News commentary coming up.
On the ninth floor of a federal courthouse in Alexandria, Virginia, they're selecting a jury that'll consider Paul Manafort's fate, which could be the rest of his life in prison. President Trump's former campaign chairman is facing bank fraud and tax evasion charges over his time years earlier as a political consultant in Ukraine. It is the first of two trials Manafort faces, stemming from special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation.
Which has nothing to do, of course, with Russia or with Donald Trump or with the presidential election campaign of 2016.
Judge Andrew Napolitano is Fox News senior judicial analyst.
But it is a either attribute or defect, depending upon which side of the aisle you sit on, of our system, that when prosecutors find evidence that they don't expect to find, they are permitted and in some cases must continue down the rabbit hole where they find it and then decide if there's enough evidence to prosecute. And they did that with respect to Manafort. That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is they're only after him using extreme measures, three indictments, two different judges, two different jurisdictions, solitary confinement, in order to squeeze him to cough up whatever he knows about his former boss, now the president.
The judge in this case has said, look, I understand what the motive here is, prosecutors. They're trying to get dirt on the Trump campaign. So the judge says this, but he allows the trial to go forward.
Well,
what would you have done if you were the judge?
Okay, well, I will answer that. The reason I'm smiling is because everybody knows this is done, but judges rarely say it. If the judge had thrown out the indictment because he suspected the motivation of the prosecutors was inappropriate, it would have been reinstated by the Fourth Circuit, because he sits in Virginia. It's the federal appeals court for that part of the country, and assigned to another judge.
But that would have delayed this a while, wouldn't it?
Correct. Not substantially, but by a couple of months.
All right, so we're talking a lot of stuff that all dates back to his time.
Pre-Trump.
Years of political consulting in Ukraine with pro-Russian people and all
right,
these things.
Right, but Judge Ellis has said, I don't expect to hear the word Russia, Russian, or Trump. And the prosecutor said, you won't hear it from our witnesses. We don't know what you'll hear from the other side, but you won't hear it from our witnesses because we've told them that this case has nothing to do with the president.
So how is it that they're getting dirt on the Trump campaign if Russia's not going to be brought up? I mean, if the judge says that's the motivation, but they say they're not going to bring up Russia, then how do you get the dirt?
By making the life of the defendant so miserable, or making his tenure or his likely demise in jail, meaning he'd be in jail the rest of his life, so certain that he will cough up whatever they want. Look, he had a co-defendant who was exposed to the exact same amount of time in jail that he is, which is 60 years.
Rick Gates.
6-0, right. Rick Gates.
Yep.
Rick Gates is now the government's chief witness against him. That's the testimony we want to hear, because Rick Gates, who was Paul Manafort's business partner when all this happened and was Paul Manafort's deputy when he was running the Trump campaign, which is at the same time as the meeting with the Russian agents in Trump Tower, June of 16, is also a witness against Trump before the grand juries that Mueller has impaneled.
As a case on just those merits, pretty strong.
Well, I'll tell you what the defense is, and you'll know why I'm chuckling in a minute. The defense is, I was investigated for all of this 8 years ago by a young prosecutor who was the U.S. attorney in Baltimore, and he exonerated me. He will be my first witness. Do you know who that is, Dave Anthony?
No.
Rod Rosenstein, the number two person in the DOJ today. But you can't make this up. This is a cast of characters out of a novel.
So he has to testify.
If they call him, and they said they're going to call him, and they will say to him, did you do this investigation? Yeah, I don't remember it. Oh, that's okay. We have your notes.
That now infamous Trump Tower meeting in June 2016 involving a Russian lawyer who purported to have dirt on Hillary Clinton included Paul Manafort. Donald Trump Jr. was also there. And there is a new wrinkle in that story, courtesy of Michael Cohen, President Trump's former lawyer turned nemesis. Cohen was raided by the FBI back in April, and investigators found tapes he secretly made while having conversations in his office. One was released to CNN of Cohen and then candidate Trump discussing a possible payment for the rights to a story of a Playboy model who claims to have had an affair with then-businessman Trump years earlier.
When it comes time for the financing, which will be...
Listen, what financing?
We'll have to pay you. So.
No,
I got...
Now, there's been much debate since over if the president wants to pay with cash or doesn't want to pay with cash. Cohen also made news claiming Donald Trump knew about that Trump Tower meeting before it happened. Not a year later, as the president says.
Very, very, I can't emphasize enough, damaging to the president and his son. I'll take the easier case. Donald Jr. has testified under oath that the president did not know about this meeting until it came out in the New York Times after Donald Trump was president.
Yeah, 2017.
In July of 17.
So that would put him under the same thing that a lot of these other people in this investigation, the lying under oath.
For the president... look, if there the charge is not collusion, that's not a legal word. So for Giuliani to say collusion's not a crime and the president didn't commit it, and even if he did what they said he did, he didn't engage in collusion. There's no such crime as collusion. The crime is conspiracy. Conspiracy is an agreement. If Donald Trump was part of that agreement, yeah, go ahead and meet with them and see what they have.
Now they
have
but nothing
came serious
of that
problem.
Meeting, right?
Doesn't matter. The crime is the agreement to provide dirt on Hillary, even if the dirt never arrived or even if what arrived wasn't dirt. It doesn't matter. The crime is complete when the agreement is made and one of those into the agreement takes a step in furtherance of it.
However, Cohen supposedly, reportedly, doesn't have any evidence to corroborate his claim. That makes it very difficult for the prosecutor to go after Donald Trump Jr. for lying if there's no evidence other than Cohen saying, well, he told me that.
Doesn't make it difficult for them to indict him.
Okay.
That's all they want, because once indicted, people start coughing up.
And then people will just, in the court of public opinion, it's very damaging.
Of course, of course. If the president's son is indicted and the president pardons him, we got a constitutional crisis in our hands. If the president's son is indicted and the president doesn't pardon him, they're going to squeeze him no matter who he is.
These Cohen tapes, what do you make of them?
Well, in New York State and New York City, it is not a crime to tape a conversation. You only have one party consent. You're the participant.
Right.
It is not ethical to tape a conversation with your own client without asking your client's permission. A lot of lawyers tape their clients, but with the client's permission. It's an efficient way to make notes. Without the client's permission, it's unethical. I don't think it's disbarrable, but it is certainly compensable, meaning he could be punished in some way if he survives all these other issues confronting him.
President Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, says he used to think Cohen was honorable. Now he calls him a scoundrel.
Now, if I tell you I'm not recording and I record, haven't I intended to deceive? And in fact, deceive? That may be a punishable offense.
And he told Fox and Friends on Monday,
this is a theater of the absurd.
Yeah.
The president's innocence, having done nothing wrong, has been proven over and over again.
And Giuliani says it's highly unlikely right now that the president would sit down for an interview with the special counsel, Robert Mueller.
The obstruction thing is crazy. He had a right to fire Comey. That's what it's all about.
Referring to that May 2017 dismissal of the FBI director, which led to the special counsel's appointment.
On the substance of that issue, it would be insane for any lawyer to permit his client, particularly a client who has a very high opinion of himself and doesn't use an economy of words, I'm trying to be diplomatic here, to be interviewed by prosecutors because they are very adept at tripping you up in your own words. And in that environment, lying to them, even a white lie, can form the basis of an indictment. As for Giuliani himself, I think he's not doing the president any good by his ferocious attacks on Michael Cohen, because the federal government, Bob Mueller and company, will view that as witness intimidation, And the remedy for witness intimidation by a lawyer is to kick the lawyer off the case. If Donald Trump has to go through a third set of lawyers, it'll be catastrophic financially and politically and maybe legally.
Democrats have said all along that all this stuff is just attempts by the president to obstruct this investigation. And obstruction of justice is what they want Mueller to kind of go after him
because
for.
Because it is universally agreed in the legal and judicial community that the phrase treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, that's the basis for impeachment in the Constitution, includes obstruction of justice. If he says to Jim Comey, stop investigating Mike Flynn because you have to devote your time to going after terrorists and bank robbers, he can do that as the head of the executive branch. But if he says, stop investigating Mike Flynn because it might lead to me, that's interference for a corrupt purpose. That's the crime that Mueller's looking for.
Judge Napolitano, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Pleasure, Dave.
It's the new Jerry Willis podcast.
I love giving you an edge with your money. I like to break it all down so that you wind up with more money in your pocket, more confidence in your future.
Find it now on FoxNewsPodcast.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Jonah Goldberg.
What's on your mind?
So I was on Fox News Sunday, which actually is the 100-day mark from the midterm elections. And one of the topics that we talked about was whether or not the booming economy, and it does appear to be booming, will help Republicans in the midterms. And I think one of the reasons to be a little skeptical about this is that while it's absolutely true that a lot of elections are based on the economy, the old phrase being, it's the economy, stupid, a better way to understand it is that elections are always about the economy, except for the ones that aren't. So, for example, in 2002, George W. Bush's first midterm election, historically, he should have lost seats, but 9/11 and the war on terror were the big issue. We've seen this kind of thing in other midterm elections. Other issues can move forward. The real challenge for the Republicans going into the 2018 midterms is that it really depends on which seats we're looking at. Historically, in the first term of a president's administration, they tend to lose 24 seats. The Democrats need 24 seats. They also, parties tend to lose seats that are open, meaning that the incumbent retired. And in wave elections, those seats almost overwhelmingly go to the opposition party of the president. The really unique thing here is that despite the booming economy, the places where the Republican brand and Trump's popularity are the lowest, at least in the places that matter, are in suburban swing districts, including 8 districts that Hillary Clinton carried in the 2016 election. And Trump's unpopularity with white college-educated women is unprecedented. We have an unprecedented gender gap going into these midterms. And so these women or these voters, these suburban voters, have already priced in a good economy. They're benefiting from the tax cuts. They're benefiting from the roaring growth. And yet they still have a problem with Republicans or the administration. It may not cause them to vote Democrat, but it certainly is possible that it may cause them not to vote at all. And so you really have to look on a district by district basis to see whether or not this blue wave will work or will happen and whether or not the economy will fix it. I think the Republicans hold the Senate. As a conservative, I really hope they do, because that is where the really important stuff can still get done in terms of judicial appointments and all of the rest. But if the Democrats take back the House, expect lots of investigations, expect the legislative agenda of the Trump administration to come to an end. And if they lose the Senate, well, then the living will envy the dead, and we'll all be drinking puddle water and canned goods. So, for that, I'm Jonah Goldberg.
You have been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to Fox News Radio's hourly newscast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, visit foxnews.com.